Hello, everybody. This is Dan Trotter, Pretty Good Bible Studies. I am now in Exodus chapter 1, verses 1 through 22, the entire chapter, as we begin the second book of the Pentateuch, the second book of the Torah, Exodus. We left Genesis in chapter 50. Jacob and Joseph both died, and we talked all about the circumstances of their death and so forth. And so now Joseph is dead, and in chapter 1 of Exodus, a new Pharaoh shall arise and enslave Israel. This is about 200 years or so, maybe more than 200 years after the death of Joseph. So we jump ahead a couple hundred years. So we start now in Exodus 1. Well, before we start, let's do some introductory work here. First of all, the word Exodus. That's from a Latin word which is derived from the Greek, exodos. It means exit or departure. That was the name that the Septuagint translators of the Old Testament Hebrew gave the book because it referred to the exit or departure of Israel from Egypt. Now, the author of the book is Moses. Now, of course, that's controverted by a lot of liberals. I don't really give a lot of credence to liberals, as you probably know, but let me just show you how many times Moses is claimed to be the author in not only the Pentateuch itself, but also in other scriptures of both Old and New Testament. Starting in Exodus 17:14, the Lord said to Moses, write this in a book as a memorial. Exodus 24:4, Moses wrote down all the words of the Lord. Exodus 34:27, then the Lord said to Moses, write down these words. Now we leave the Pentateuch and go to Joshua 8, verse 31. Just as Moses, the servant of the Lord, had commanded the sons of Israel, as it is written in the book of the law of Moses. That means Moses wrote the book according to Joshua. Mark 7:10. This is Jesus speaking. For Moses said, honor your father and your mother. Mark 12:26. But regarding the fact that the dead rise again, have you not read in the book of Moses, in the passage about the burning bush, our God spoke to him, saying, I'm the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, the God of Jacob. That's Jesus quoting the book of Moses. Jesus thought Moses wrote the book. If Jesus thought Moses wrote the book, that's good enough for me. Let's look at Luke chapter 2, verses 22 and 23. And when the days for their purification, that's Joseph and Mary's, according to the law of Moses were completed, and then they quote the law of Moses, every firstborn male that opens the tomb. They didn't quote, Luke quotes the law of Moses. Now let's look at the chronology of the book. The traditional date says that the Exodus occurred in 1446 B.C., and then, of course, during the 40 years of wandering in the wilderness, sometime thereafter, Moses would have sat down and wrote the Pentateuch. That's the traditional date. There's another alternative date, and this is not a liberal date. This is an alternative conservative date. That's 1290 B.C. Let's see where we get the traditional date from. It comes from a passage in 1 Kings chapter 6, verse 1. Now, it came about in the 480th year after the sons of Israel came out of the land of Egypt, in the fourth year of Solomon's reign over Israel, in the month of Ziv, which is the second month, that he began to build the house of the Lord. Now, this is nice because the fourth year of Solomon's reign can be dated with precision. That's 966 B.C. I say precision. It's when you talk about ancient dates, within a year. Okay, so that's a year or two, but this is circa 966 B.C. We know that. And the passage also said this was 480 years after Israel came out of the land of Egypt. So that means 480 years after the Exodus. So you take 966, that's Solomon's reign. You add 480 years to it and it comes out to 1446 B.C. The calculation is very easy. Now, of course, remember, the book would be written sometime after 1446 because they have to wander through the... Moses didn't have time to write the Pentateuch while he's getting the people out of Egypt. But while they're sitting in the desert, wandering around, doing nothing because of their sin, that's probably when Moses wrote. Now, the alternative date is 1290 B.C., which I don't hold to. I hold to the traditional date. The NIV Study Bible has a very complicated way of coming up with 1290, and I love Occam's Razor. The simplest explanation is most likely going to be the accurate one. But after going through all the derivation, the NIV Study Bible says, quote, there are no compelling reasons to modify in any substantial way the traditional 1446 B.C. date. Hear, hear. Here's what Don Stewart on the Blue Letter Bible website says, quote, those who hold the 1290 B.C. date do so without any internal biblical evidence to support their claim. They come up with this date from archaeological evidence that is much in dispute. Let me tell you, when you start talking about archaeology, you're in trouble. Oh, well, we're about 3,000 or 4,000 years off here. So sorry. I've looked at enough of that archaeological evidence, and I look at it with a, I take it all with a grain of salt. And besides, the 1290 date really does contradict Judges 11:26, which I shall read now. While Israel lived 300 years in Heshbon and Aroer and their surrounding villages, and in all the cities that are on the banks of the Arnon, why didn't you take them back at that time? Now this is Jephthah talking to the king of the Ammonites, and he says that Israel had lived for 300 years. Heshbon and Aroer sounds like Ammonite towns, but Israelites had been, let's put it this way, they'd been out of Egypt for over 300 years. Well, you take 300 years and you subtract that from 1290 BC, the alleged date of the Exodus, because the Exodus would have had to take place 300 years before the Israelites ended up in Heshbon and Aroer. So 1290 minus 300, that's 990 BC. Well, that's way past the time of the judges. That's into the monarchy. The judges period is 1380 to 1050. So I don't think the 1290 date's going to fly. Well, let's move from the alleged or the controverted date of the authorship of the book of Exodus. Now let's look at the route of the Exodus. That's also controversial. Three routes have been proposed: the northern route, the middle route, and the southern route. The northern route would take the Israelites straight up there along the Mediterranean coast, right on up as you go from west to east and start turning north up the Mediterranean coast. That's the land of the Philistines. There was a coast road there also. And somehow they ended up in Egypt and Israel that way. The middle route, they would go eastward across the Sinai Desert. They go through the desert of Shur. They would cross the Wadi El Arish, Beer Haleroi, where Hagar was visited by the angel of the Lord. And then they would go a little bit north and east and end up at Beersheba. And then on from Beersheba on with the rest of the story. That's the middle route. The southern route says that what they did is they went over in the Bitter Lakes region, which is basically where the Suez Canal is today, right north and east of the Suez Canal. They crossed somewhere the Reed Sea there, Sea of Reeds, which is part of the Red Sea. Again, nobody knows where that is exactly, but they crossed it. And then they went down, once they crossed it, they were in the Sinai Peninsula, and they went down the western coast of the Sinai Peninsula all the way down to the tip. Then they turned around at the southeastern extremity of the Sinai Peninsula and went back north again and then on into the wilderness of Zin and the wilderness of Paran, wilderness of Zin, and so forth. The NIV Study Bible says the southern route seems most likely. That's the route I'm more familiar with, I guess, because that's the first map I grabbed. So we'll go with that just for hypothetical reasons, just for the sake of trying to keep this as simple as possible, we say the southern route. Now, where they crossed the Red Sea, that's a big internet controversy, too. I remember finding somebody that gave an interesting idea that it wasn't the Sea of Reeds, that it was the Gulf of Aqaba over there that they crossed. And he had all this evidence, and it turns out, apparently, he's a nut job, because I wrote this suggestion to a friend of mine who's an expert on Genesis. He actually works for one of these creation ministries. And he told me in no uncertain terms, no, that's not true. So we don't know where the Israelites crossed the Sea of Reeds or exactly where their route was. It's a shame because I'd like to know, but we don't know. So now let's start in Exodus chapter 1, verses 1 through 5. Now these are the names of the sons of Israel who came to Egypt with Jacob. They came each one with his household: Reuben, Simeon, Levi, and Judah, Issachar, Zebulun, and Benjamin, Dan, and Naphtali, Gad, and Asher. All the persons who came from the loins of Jacob were 70 in number, but Joseph was already in Egypt. Because Joseph was already in Egypt, that's why he's not listed in these names of these sons of Jacob who came into Egypt, because Joseph was already there. Now, this mention of all the patriarchs shows that Exodus is a continuation of Genesis, of course. Now, these sons are listed in the way they are actually listed in birth order, in chronological order, but not exactly. Because the wives' sons are mentioned first, Leah, and then Rachel, and then the sons of the concubines last, Bilhah and Zilpah. Got to give honor to the legitimate wives. Now, excuse me, not legitimate, but to the senior wives, let's put it that way. That is something I still have trouble getting my hands around. I mean, you know, Leah and Rachel are having a battle of the births, who's going to have the most kids, and so Rachel says, okay, well, I can't have a baby. Well, here, Abraham, you take my maid, Bilhah, and you get her pregnant. Well, you know, can you imagine somebody coming to you and saying, Can you imagine your wife coming to you and saying, hey, I got somebody else. I want you to have sex with me and adopt the baby. That sounds like something you see on Lifetime movie or Jerry Springer or something. But that's what they did it back then. Let me give you the overall birth order, including the concubines. We start with Leah. She had Reuben 1, Simeon 2, Levi 3, Judah 4. Rachel tries to compete with her handmaid Bilhah. Bilhah has Dan and Naphtali. So Dan is 5 and Naphtali is 6. Leah says, okay, well, you're going to use your handmaid Bilhah. I use my handmaid Zilpah and I'll compete with you. So she has, Zilpah has Gad and Asher. That's 7 and 8. And then Leah says, well, looky here, I can still get pregnant. She had Issachar and Zebulun. That's 9 and 10. And Rachel says, well, you get pregnant, I can get pregnant too. And so she has Joseph. That's 11. And unfortunately, she had Benjamin on the way back to Canaan land from Syria, and she died on the way from Hebron, on the way from Bethel to Hebron, somewhere near Benjamin. But those are your 12 patriarchs. Very important. If I were teaching a course in Genesis, I'd say you need to learn the patriarchs, who their parents were, and in correct birth order. And then I want you to get a map of Israel, and I want you to show me where everyone inherited their tribe. And you learned about half of the Old Testament just by doing that. Now, in verse 5, it says that all the persons who came from the loins of Jacob were 70. Now, I've gone over this a lot in the appropriate place in Genesis 46. There's a couple of problems with that. First of all, 70 is an approximate number. The reason being is that Ur and Onan were male sons of Jacob, but they died in Canaan before the patriarchs and their families made the trip down to Egypt. So that knocks them down to 68. And then Ephraim and Manasseh were born in Egypt, so they didn't come down to Egypt. And we're assuming that Joseph came to Egypt, even though he was carried down there as a slave. So you take 70 minus Ur, Onan, Ephraim, and Manasseh, and you end up with 66. And that number is actually listed in the text somewhere. I don't have it in front of me in Genesis 46. Well, that's not a major problem. That's not a problem at all, actually. But now there's also textual differences between the Masoretic and the Septuagint text. The Masoretic text says there were 70. And again, that's rounded off from 66. And the Septuagint says there were 75. So let's look at the places in the Old Testament where the Pentateuch says that 70 offspring of Jacob came down to Egypt. Genesis 46:27. And the sons of Joseph who were born to him in Egypt were 2. All the persons of the house of Jacob who came to Egypt were 70. As the NIV Study Bible says, that's the Masoretic text. It says 70. Exodus 1:5. And by the way, all of our English translations are translated from the Masoretic text. Exodus 1:5. All the persons who came from the loins of Jacob were 70 in number, but Jacob was already in Egypt. 70 in number. Deuteronomy 10:22. Your fathers went down to Egypt, 70 persons in all. All right, so Masoretic text, 70. But in the New Testament, remember the New Testament people, characters, they use the Septuagint translation, the Greek translation of the Hebrew text. And we see that most prominently here in Acts 7:14 when Stephen is talking to his Sanhedrin persecutors and he's given the history of Israel. And Stephen says this, then Joseph sent word and invited Jacob, his father, and all his relatives to come to him, 75 persons in all. Well, if you go back and look at the Septuagint text that Stephen used at Genesis 46:20, we see added to the genealogy there one more son to Manasseh, 2 more sons to Ephraim, that's 3, and 1 grandson of Manasseh, that's 4, and 1 grandson of Ephraim, that's 5, which makes 75. So that explains the differences there. Now in verse 1, it says, now these are the names of the sons of Israel. When I read it just now, I'm thinking Israel, the land of Israel. No, that's Jacob, the person of Israel, the sons of Jacob who came to Egypt. Now we go to Exodus chapter 1, verses 6 and 7. Joseph died and all his brothers and all that generation. But the sons of Israel were fruitful and increased greatly and multiplied and became exceedingly mighty so that the land was filled with them. Now let's do some dates here. Joseph died. From the death of Joseph to the rise of this new king, we're going to read about in verse 8 that forgot Joseph was about 200 years. It was over 200 years according to the NIV Study Bible. And that's probably why the new king forgot who Joseph was, just because of the length of time. Now, Joseph died, but he was not buried in Egypt, as we know. He was buried in Shechem. He was carried up there. His bones were carried, or his embalmed corpse, actually, was carried by Moses and buried at Shechem. One might wonder what happened to Reuben and Simeon and Levi and all the brothers of Judah and Issachar and Zebulun and Dan and Naphtali. Where were they buried? Well, the scripture doesn't say. Josephus says they were buried in Hebron, and that wouldn't surprise me. That's where all the other patriarchs were buried. Now, it says Joseph died, and many Jews assume that he died before all of his brothers did. The scripture does not say that. We don't know when he died, who died first of all his brothers. Now, verse 7 tells us, as a matter of historical fact, that the sons of Israel were fruitful and increased greatly. And, of course, that's going to lead to some trouble with their Egyptian host. But before we get to that, let's talk about this idea of fruitful. Remember, the whole idea of Abraham's promises to Abraham, land, offspring, and blessing. Your offspring will be as the dust of the sea and the stars of the sky, innumerable, uncountable. Well, this is just showing how this is going to happen. And as a matter of fact, this promise of fruitfulness to the Hebrews had been given to many, many of our Jewish forefathers. For example, Adam. Well, I don't know if you'd say Adam was Jewish, but let's say this, put it this way, to our Old Testament forefathers. And Adam, in Genesis 1:28, we read this, God blessed them, Adam and Eve, and God said to them, be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth and subdue it, and rule over the fish of the sea, etc., etc. He repeated the promise to Noah. Genesis 8:17. This is after the flood. Bring out with you every living thing of all flesh that is with you, birds and animals and every creeping thing that creeps on the earth, that they may breed abundantly on the earth and be fruitful and multiply. It's not talking about people there. It's talking about animals, but that's all right because we go to the next chapter, Genesis 9:1. And God blessed Noah and his sons and said to them, be fruitful and multiply. So that's the people that are supposed to be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth. Genesis 9:7, as for you, be fruitful and multiply. That's again Noah, populate the earth abundantly and multiply in it. The command to Abraham, the command to be fruitful and multiply was also given to Abraham. Genesis 17:2, this is at the time of the circumcision covenant. God says this, I will establish my covenant between me and you, and I will multiply you exceedingly. Genesis 17:6, again, circumcision covenant time. God says to Abraham, I will make you exceedingly fruitful. Well, there's fruitful and multiply. Genesis 22, this is the time of the virtual sacrifice of Isaac on Mount Moriah. God says to Abraham, indeed, I will greatly bless you, and I will greatly multiply your seed as the stars of heaven and as the sand which is on the seashore. And your seed shall possess the gate of their enemies. So, same command going through the patriarchs. Let's go next to Isaac, Abraham's son. Genesis 26:4. I will multiply your descendants as the stars of heaven and will give your descendants all these lands, and by your descendants all the nations of the earth shall be blessed. I will multiply your descendants. Be fruitful and multiply. That's given to Isaac at the time of his conflict with the king of Gerar, Abimelech. The next patriarch down is Isaac's son, Jacob. Genesis 28:14, this is Jacob's at Bethel the first time on his way out to Syria. Your descendants, God says, will also be like the dust of the earth. That's a lot of descendants. And you will spread out to the west and to the east and to the north and to the south. Genesis 35:11, this is God speaking to Jacob at Bethel on the way back from Syria. God said, also said to him, I am God Almighty, be fruitful and multiply. Well, there's that phrase again, a nation and a company of nations will come from you. And this is Genesis 48. This is when Jacob is blessing Ephraim and Manasseh separately from the other brothers, separately from Joseph's other brothers. God said to me, said to Jacob, as Jacob is quoting this, quoting God, he says, this is what God said to me. Behold, I will make you fruitful and numerous. I will make you a company of peoples. Well, by the time we get to the end of this story in Exodus, the Israelites are going to be about 600,000 men. They went down there with roughly 70 and they leaving with 600,000. That fruitful and multiply promise was answered big time. And it's ironic. The multiplication of Israel happened in the land that enslaved them, not in the promised land. So going back to verse 7 in Exodus 1, but the sons of Israel were fruitful and increased greatly, thus fulfilling all those other promises of God to the patriarchs. They were fruitful, they increased greatly, and they multiplied, they became exceedingly mighty, so that the land was filled with them. That's not the land of Canaan, that's not the land of Egypt, that's the land of Goshen where they lived. Obviously, they didn't flood all over Egypt. We go now to Exodus 1, verses 8 through 10. Now a new king arose over Egypt who did not know Joseph. He said to his people, behold, the people of the sons of Israel are more and mightier than we. Come, let us deal wisely with them, or else they will multiply, and in the event of war, They will also join themselves to those who hate us and fight against us and depart from the land. Now, who is this new king? Well, nobody knows. The NIV Study Bible says it's probably Amos the First, but I've seen 100 other speculations. Amos the First is a kind of a big one because he founded the 18th dynasty, which is the big dynasty in Egyptian history. I just finished listening to a whole bunch of Egyptian history podcasts because I was planning to take a trip to Egypt before I was shut down because of that COVID-19 virus. And preparing for it, I realized that everything's all about the 18th dynasty. That's where all the records are, the monuments are, and that's what all the historians write about. 18th dynasty is 1550 to 1292, and Joseph could, of course, be in there. Joseph's dates are highly controverted. You look on the web and you'll see about, you won't see too much, because it all depends on which pharaoh you're talking about. Do you take the earlier, the late date of Exodus and so forth? So I'm going to assume he is about 13th century B.C. in the 1200s. I think that is a rough estimate. And that would fall in the middle of the 18th dynasty. And that's roughly 200 plus years after the early date of the Exodus, which is 1456 or so. But at any rate, a new king arose over Egypt. Now, those who speculate that this new king who put the Israelites in slavery, that was Amos the First, as the NIV Study Bible speculates, this king expelled the famous Hyksos, the foreign rulers, predominantly Semitic rulers that came from Canaan or the Arabian Desert or wherever they came from. They came into Egypt. Hardly anybody knows anything about the Hyksos if you'll read the literature on it. But if this is true, then that would explain why this new king was worried about the Hebrews in Goshen, because that's where the Hyksos came from, the northeast of Egypt, Goshen. Now, this new pharaoh did not know Joseph. A couple hundred years later, he doesn't know Joseph because Joseph and his contemporaries had died. The problem with that is Joseph was pretty famous, and one would think that a ruler would know about Joseph 200 years later. Here's what the Ellicott commentator, Mr. Ellicott, says about that. Quote, "It seems to be implied that for some considerable time after his death, the memory of the benefits conferred by Joseph upon Egypt had protected his kinsfolk. But in the shifts and changes incident to politics, especially to Oriental politics, this condition of things had passed away. The new king felt under no obligation to him, perhaps was even ignorant of his name. He viewed the political situation apart from all personal predilections and saw a danger in it." In other words, this new king, I mean, he might have even known that Joseph had done a lot of good for Egypt 200 years before, but that was 200 years ago. Now we got a problem. We're not going to worry about the memory of Joseph when we got a clear and present danger with all these potential spies and fifth columnists who might make military alliances with our enemies on our borders up there. And so Joseph is not helping his descendants at all. His fame is not helping the Hebrews in Egypt at all. Now, this idea that the king would not know Joseph anymore would even be more accentuated if this new king was of a different dynasty. If he was of a different dynasty, there would be more of a chance that he didn't know or care about Joseph. It could be that the Hebrew translated there that says that the new king did not know Joseph, it might be translated as the new king had no regard for the memory of Joseph. Here's what John Gill suggests that, and Adam Clark says this, the Hebrew verb yada, God help me if I pronounce that wrong, the verb yada, which we translate to know, often signifies to acknowledge or approve. So maybe it's translated as the Pharaoh had no approval of Joseph. It doesn't matter. Joseph's memory did not help the Hebrews in Goshen. Now, the Pharaoh described the Hebrews in Goshen when he was talking to his people, his ministers. He said, "The people of the sons of Israel are more and mightier than we." Really? The Hebrew shepherds are mightier than the Pharaoh? No, that can't be. He's just talking. He's pumping the problem up a little bit to try to do something about it. Or it could be, as John Gill suggests, that the Hebrews were mightier than the Egyptians if you looked only at the land of Goshen. Now, that might be true because there were more Hebrews there than Egyptians. But at any rate, the Pharaoh says to his people, these Hebrews will join themselves to those who hate us and fight against us, and then they'll leave. Well, that's a legitimate complaint, a legitimate concern, that if you got people in the kingdom that are not loyal to you, that might be loyal to somebody outside. I mean, remember John F. Kennedy running for president in the 1960s. Everybody was concerned that he might be loyal to the Pope because he was a Catholic. Then a lot of people in American politics say, oh, the Jews are more loyal to Israel than they are to America. I mean, that's gone on. during World War One. Oh, the Germans are going to be more loyal to Germany than they are to America. During World War II, oh, the Japanese in California are going to be more loyal to the Japanese than they are to America. That's an old story. And so the Pharaoh is probably legitimate about it. Now, let me read you a quote from Adam Clark about this. Quote, it has been conjectured that Pharaoh had probably his eye on the oppressions which Egypt had suffered under the shepherd kings. Now, Clark is referring to the Hyksos. He calls them shepherd kings. I'm going to show you now that nobody calls them the shepherd kings anymore. And also, there's a lot of people who don't think that the shepherd kings actually oppressed the Egyptians. But it was a long time felt that way because of the Egyptian historian Manetho, who lived, I think, what, 3rd century B.C.? He lived during the Ptolemies. And, of course, Adam Clark is writing in the 19th century before all of those late academic shifts. So with that in mind, let me continue reading. According to Clark, these shepherd kings, for a long series of years, according to Manetho, the famous Egyptian chronicler, these Hyksos had governed the land with extreme cruelty. As the Israelites were of the same occupation, viz. Shepherds, the jealous, cruel king found it easy to attribute to them the same motives, taking it for granted that they were only waiting for a favorable opportunity to join the enemies of Egypt and so overrun the whole land. All right, now, shepherd kings that Clark refers to, all the old commentators talk about the shepherd kings of the Hyksos. It should be foreign kings, not shepherd kings, and that ruins his argument that the Israelites were identified with Hyksos shepherd kings because the Israelites were also shepherds. It just completely ruins the argument. Where did the term shepherd kings come from? It came from Josephus, our famous first century Hellenic Jewish historian. He wrongly translated the Egyptian there. He thought the Egyptian meant shepherd kings. Eusebius of Caesarea, the famous 4th century AD church historian, corrected that translation to foreign kings, and that's really what it should be now, according to most learned academic opinion. So we're going to forget the Hyksos coming in, being shepherds, and the Hebrew slaves being shepherds. They would have affinity with the Hyksos, and therefore they would be a danger to the Egyptian state. That's not so. I think that the Pharaoh, whoever he was just upset because there was a lot of them down there, and they might make an alliance with a foreign enemy. Now, the other fear the Pharaoh had was that the Hebrews would depart the land. Now, you would think, well, so what? You're worried about them making an alliance. Well, if they leave the land, they're not going to make alliances with the enemies anymore. And if you really hate them, personally, I don't know if they did or not, but if the Pharaoh hates the Israelites, why would you care if they left? Seems like you'd be happy. Well, my speculation on that is the Israelites must have been paying a lot of taxes. And eventually, of course, they made them slaves and they had free slave labor. I mean, think about it. This type of slavery was such that the Egyptians were not responsible for their room and board. With slavery in the American South, for example, the slave owners had to they not only had to take care of room and board, they had to take care of disputes between the slaves, they had to take care of medical problems, they had to feed the slaves, they had to clothe the slaves, they had to do all that kind of stuff. But with this Egyptian slavery, they just said, make the bricks. They didn't give them any materials to make the bricks with, and they didn't give them any food, and they didn't give them any clothes. So the Egyptians were getting a lot of free labor here, or if they weren't enslaved, I'm sure they were paying taxes to the Egyptian government, and they were wealthy. And so that would be a large lot of money that the Pharaoh would be losing. And so he says, well, I don't want them to leave, but I don't want them to be free to make alliances with foreign countries either, so we'll just do something better. We'll take care of both of those problems. We'll make them slaves. If they're slaves, they can't leave, and if they're slaves, they can't make alliances with foreign governments. Now, Pharaoh's worrying about leaving was probably because he had heard of them always talking about their promised land. You know, that was part of Hebrew culture, the promised land. The promised Abraham, land, offspring, and blessings, land. John Gill suggests that idea. Now, one thing Pharaoh didn't think about by making the Hebrew slaves is slaves never produce as much as free people who are working on their own profit for their own motive. I remember reading American history. There was a 19th century free market economist who came over to study the Southern slave system. And that was one thing he said over and over again, how inefficient the slave system was. He wasn't talking morality. He was talking about economic efficiency. He says it's just totally inefficient. Because the slaves, all they care about is doing a little bit of work and going back at the end of the day, doing as little bit of work as they can. They have no incentive. They work. It doesn't increase their material well. If they work well and efficiently, it doesn't increase their material benefits that much. I know I've read a bunch of historians about slavery in the South, and some of them say that the slaves actually developed a lot of sophisticated farming techniques, and I don't know enough about that to know, and I'm sure that might be true. I don't have any doubt of that, but still, if your free labor works much more efficiently than slave labor, that's just bottom line. You can count on that. So the Pharaoh, in trying to keep the slaves in the Hebrew, trying to make the Hebrew slaves in his country, it's not like it's going to be 100% pure profit. There's going to be a downside to it. We go now to Exodus 1, 11 through 14. So they appointed taskmasters over them to afflict them with hard labor, and they built for Pharaoh storage cities. The them, there's the Hebrew slaves. And so the Hebrew slaves built for Pharaoh storage cities, Pithom and Ramses. But the more they afflicted them, the more the Egyptians afflicted the Hebrews, the more the Hebrews multiplied and the more they spread out so that the Egyptians were in dread of the sons of Israel. The Egyptians compelled the sons of Israel to labor rigorously, and they made their lives bitter with hard labor in mortar and bricks, and at all kinds of labor in the field, all their labors which they rigorously imposed on them. Now these two storage cities, Pithom and Ramses, they were public granaries. Let me read you from Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown. Quote, these two store places were in the land of Goshen, and being situated near a border liable to invasion, that's the northeast border of Egypt, which is, of course, next to Israel, which is also next to the Sinai Desert, which is close to the Arabian Desert, where other people can come in, Bedouin tribes, for example. So they were near a border, so they were fortified cities, militarily fortified. Pithom, the Greek is Patumas, lay on the eastern Pelusiac branch of the Nile. That's a big branch of the Nile, Pelusiac branch. About 12 Roman miles from Heliopolis, that's On. Heliopolis is the Greek name, On is the Egyptian name, and it's now in present-day Cairo, right at the very northern end of the Nile River before the Nile splits into a whole bunch of different deltas. The other city is Ramses, called by the Septuagint Hierapolis. Ramses lay between the same branch of the Nile, the Pelusiac branch, and the Bitter Lakes. The Bitter Lakes are the lakes that are now where the Suez Canal is, right north and west of the Suez Gulf, that part of the Red Sea that's the Suez Gulf, as you're going toward the Mediterranean Sea. So that's where Ramses is. These two fortified cities were situated, therefore, in the same valley, and the fortifications which Pharaoh commanded to be built around both had probably the same common object of obstructing the entrance into Egypt, which this valley furnished the enemy from Asia. All right, so there's a valley there. Pithom and Ramses are in that valley, and their military cities, their store cities, there to defend the border. Now, let's look at more particularly Pithom. The Egyptian is Patum, the house of Tum, the sun god. It was probably the Patumas of the Greek historian Herodotus. I'm reading from Easton's, which is a 19th century dictionary. Even in the 19th century, Pithom had been satisfactorily identified with Tel el Maskuta, about 12 miles west of Ismailia and 20 east of Tel el Kabir, on the southern bank of the present Suez Canal. All right, you're not going to know what all those places are. I sure don't, but we know it's near where the Suez Canal is. Here have recently, that's in 1883, been discovered the ruins of supposed grain chambers and other evidences to show that this was a great store city. Its immense ruin heaps show that it was built of bricks and partly also of bricks without straw. Interestingly enough, built of bricks and bricks without straw. Does that sound familiar? Succoth is supposed by some to be the secular name of the city. In other words, Succoth is another name for Pithom, Pithom being the sacred name. The house of Tum, the sun god. This was the first halting place of the Israelites in the Exodus. We'll get there in Exodus 12. We'll talk about when they arrive at Succoth, which some believe to be Pithom. Now, the other city is Ramses. Ramses is mentioned here and in two other places in the Pentateuch. It doubtless refers to the great Egyptian pharaoh Ramses II, who governed between 1279 B.C. and 1213 B.C. This is the NIV Study Bible. It says it refers to Ramses II. Now, of course, that's 1279 to 1213 is much later than the Exodus here. So, and Moses is, of course, dead by then. So Moses could not have put Ramses as the city here. So that designation of the city here as Ramses involves an editorial updating by somebody who was editing Moses' work. The city of Ramses is also known as Goshen. The land of Goshen has a capital city, Goshen. People would conflate the name of the region with the name of the big city there. It's also known as Zoan, as mentioned twice in Psalm 78, Zoan. Now let's see what Easton's Bible Dictionary, Easton's Illustrated Dictionary, has to say about Ramses, the city. Quote, after the Hebrews had built Ramses, one of the treasure cities, it came to be known as the land in which that city was built. The city bearing this name was probably identical with Zoan, which Ramses II rebuilt. It became a special residence and ranked next in importance and magnificence to Thebes. Thebes, of course, was the Upper Egypt's, Southern Egypt's famous capital city, present-day Luxor. And so Zoan, Ramses, was compared in magnificence to that. Huge masses of bricks made of Nile mud, sun-dried, some of them mixed with stubble. Think about that. Some of the bricks had stubble, some of them not. Doesn't that sound like what happened with the Jews? These bricks, possibly molded by Jewish hands, still mark the site of Ramses. This was the general rendezvous of the Israelites before they began their march out of Egypt. Now, of course, the old name was Zoan. Ramses is the name that was given because of Ramses II, several hundred years after Moses' death, added by an editorial writer to use the current name of the city. Now, in our passage here, Exodus 1, verse 14, the Egyptians are said to make the Hebrew slaves' lives bitter with hard labor. That bitterness was commemorated in the Passover meal, which was eaten with bitter herbs, as the NIV Study Bible says. Also in verse 13, the Egyptians are said to treat the Hebrew slaves rigorously. That's sort of a weak translation, really. The Hebrew word is befarach. According to Adam Clark, it means with cruelty, great oppression, being ferocious with them. The word fierce is supposed by some to be derived from the Hebrew as well as the Latin ferox, from which we more immediately bring our English term. This kind of cruelty to slaves and ferociousness, unfeelingness, and hard-heartedness were particularly forbidden to the children of Israel. Now let's look at the way Hebrews were supposed to treat their slaves. Leviticus 25:43. You are not to rule over them harshly, but fear your God. Leviticus 25:46. You may leave them to your sons after you to inherit as property. You can make them slaves for life. But concerning your brothers, the Israelites, you must not rule over one another harshly. We go now to Exodus chapter 1, verses 15 through 17. Then the king of Egypt spoke to the Hebrew midwives, one of whom was named Shiphrah and the other was named Puah. And he said, this king of Egypt, of course, is the new king, the Pharaoh. And he said, when you are helping the Hebrew women to give birth and see them upon the birth stool, if it is a son, then you shall put him to death. But if it is a daughter, then she shall live. But the midwives feared God and did not do as the king of Egypt had commanded them, but let the boys live. Now, there was only two midwives here, Shiphrah and Puah, and there's an immediate question. Why only two? You got two midwives and you got all the population of Israel having babies. How are two midwives going to handle all those babies and kill all those sons? Because the Israelites are very numerous, of course. Well, here's some options. Option number one, it could be that Shiphrah and Puah, those two midwives, were in charge of other Hebrew midwives. They were just the ones in charge. And so the ones in charge then command the other midwives to kill the sons also. I think that makes a lot of sense. The second option is the Pharaoh just talked to two of the midwives, Shiphrah and Puah, and figured that those two midwives would spread the word and terrorize the rest of the midwives. That's John Calvin's solution. Option number three is that the midwives were rarely called upon to give birth, and so all the Pharaoh had to do was talk to two midwives because most of the time it was female family relatives who took care of most of the births. Well, of course, that doesn't make any sense, really, because how is that going to stop the Hebrew male population, which is what Pharaoh wanted, if he's going to midwives when he knows that the midwives are carrying out very few births? So that can't be it. I think that Shiphrah and Puah were probably in charge of all the other Hebrew midwives. Now, there's some question as to whether the midwives were Egyptian or Hebrew. In favor of them being Hebrew is the fact that their names are Hebrew, not Egyptian. And also there's a question, why in the world would Hebrews have Egyptian midwives? So in my opinion, they were Hebrew. Those who say they were Egyptian argue that the Pharaoh would never have asked Hebrew women to do such a thing, to kill their own Hebrew sons. It would be so absurd that a Pharaoh would never ask a Hebrew midwife to do that. No Hebrew woman would have even thought about doing it. That's a pretty good argument too, actually. So I don't know who they were, but whoever they were, they feared God. Verse 17, that tends to make me feel that they were Hebrew Hebrew midwives because they feared God. Now, how could the midwife kill the Hebrew son being born? Here's how John Gill puts it, quote, "Give it a private pinch as it comes forth, as the son comes forth. Give it a private pinch as it comes forth while under their hands, that its death might seem to be owing to the difficulty of its birth. To secretly kill the baby as it comes out, it's disgusting." Now, a question arises here in verse 16. Pharaoh says he wants the girl Hebrew children to live, only kill the sons. Why? Well, the girl children couldn't hurt him militarily because they're not going to grow up to be soldiers. And that's probably the reason. I guess if you think about it, if Pharaoh started killing all the babies, the boys as well as the girls, that's the first recipe for a slave revolt. So I imagine he says it's not worth the trouble to kill the girls. But John Gill's got a wonderful idea. He wanted to let the girls live so that those girls could gratify the lust of the Egyptians because the Hebrews were more beautiful than the Egyptians. I tell you that, John Gill, he's a man of a fertile imagination. I give him 5 exclamation points on that one. That's nonsense, in my humble opinion. Now, these Hebrew midwives said they were said to fear God, verse 17. That's reverential trust, of course. That's not abject, shaking terror. In verse 17, it says the midwives did not do as the king of Egypt had commanded. Their lawful political authority, they disobeyed it. That's not the only time that happens in the Bible. You remember Peter and the apostles in Acts 5:29 when they were told not to preach by the Sanhedrin, and their response was, "We must obey God rather than men." This is a good verse for those who say that Romans 13 enjoins blind obedience to a government. The Bible does not say that we obey unjust governments any more than we're supposed to obey unjust husbands who are beating and abusing their wives. All the scriptures that talk about obedience are talking about obeying just authority. But when the authority is unjust, when the Chinese government says you can't preach the gospel, come on. You can't obey that kind of nonsense. You obey them when it comes to the traffic laws, the alcoholic laws, the immigration laws, that kind of stuff, because that's what legitimate governments do. But when they tell you you can't preach the gospel, you don't do it. And when a government authority tells a midwife to commit murder, you don't do it. When the Sanhedrin tells Peter and the rest of the apostles not to preach the gospel, they said, "No, we're not going to listen to you." We go now to Exodus 1, verses 18 through 22. "So the king of Egypt called for the midwives and said to them, 'Why have you done this thing and let the boys live?' The midwives said to Pharaoh, 'Because the Hebrew women are not as the Egyptian women, for they are vigorous and give birth before the midwife can get to them.' So God was good to the midwives, and the people multiplied and became very mighty. Because the midwives feared God, he established households for them. Then Pharaoh commanded all his people, saying, 'Every son who is born you are to cast into the Nile, and every daughter you are to keep alive.'" Verse 18, the king of Egypt called for the midwives, and the reason he did, and that's probably the two lead midwives, Shifra and Pua. What's going on here? He probably saw that the Israelites were still getting bigger and bigger and bigger, more and more people. His commands were not carried out. Now, when he confronts the midwives, they give him, which on the surface seems to be a really dumb reason why they can't kill the babies, because the Hebrew women are vigorous. They're more vigorous than the Egyptian women, and we can't get there to stop the birth, to kill the baby? Well, that sounds absurd, but as a matter of fact, it might have actually been true. It could be that the Hebrew mothers deliberately refused to call the midwives. They might have heard that the midwives were tasked with murdering their sons, and so they said, "No, we'll do this birth on our own. We're not going to use a midwife." And so the midwives never got there. And so if the midwife happens to show up, "Oh, look at here, the baby's already been born." Adam Clark points out that women working hard in fields usually have quick and easy labor. I don't know if that's true. I don't know if he's an obstetrician, but he's a polymath. Maybe he does know something about obstetrics. I don't know, but that's his view. So it could have been true that those slave women, those Hebrew slaves, gave birth so quick that the midwives couldn't get there. Now let's discuss the age-old controversy of whether these midwives sinned by lying or not. You know, there's a lot of people who have absolute views on lying. You should never lie. I investigated this when I was at Trinity Seminary, Trinity Evangelical Divinity School. I had the famous Norman Geisler as an ethics professor, and he had a whole section on this. I still remember the discussion because it was fascinating. And I finally came to the conclusion that, oh, come on. In some situations, of course, it's all right to lie. For example, the Gestapo in Nazi Germany comes into your house and say, "Where are you hiding the Jews?" You say, "Oh, just go up there and take a left right up there, right next to the bathroom, go in there and shoot them all and kill them." Yeah, sure. No, there's nothing wrong with lying to people who are going to murder somebody. I don't know why that's such a hard ethical thing, but some people get all balled up about it. I remember one time I was at a party at the University of South Carolina, and there were some Columbia Bible College students there, and there was this real fundamentalist type girl there. I mean, she looked fundamentalist, and she talked that way, and she kept talking about Henry Kissinger being the Antichrist and all this kind of stuff, and she was all into late great planet Earth. And so I don't know what, of course, at this time I had no idea. I'd spend 23 years of my life in communist China breaking the law constantly, telling people about Jesus. So I didn't know that at the time, but we got off on that conversation somehow, and I said, "Sure, it's all right to lie." I think we were talking about Brother Andrew. It's all right to lie if you need to get into the country, or you need to avoid getting caught or getting some of your native Christians caught. Oh, she wasn't going to have that. Oh, no, that's a sin. And I remember thinking, I need to investigate this further, because that girl sounds like she knows what she's talking about, and she's so spiritual. Well, she didn't know what the Gehenna she was talking about, in my humble opinion. If I'd have thought about it, if I'd have been as well prepared as I am now, I would have said, "Well, what about the Hebrew midwives? They sinned." Or rather, they lied, and they didn't sin, because God blessed them, did good to them, gave them a household, it says here. Saved the boys from dying. What's wrong with that? That's a good thing. I mean, deceit is not always wrong. If I'm playing basketball and I fake left and dribble right, well, didn't I deceive the opponent? Come on. I'm not teaching situation ethics. In the normal situation, of course, you don't lie. But when people's lives are at stake, what about a general? He says, "Well, you know, I'm going to faint here. And then attack, I'm going to feint on my left flank and attack on my right flank." Is he lying? No, he's just being a general. That's what you're supposed to do. So in that situation, or in the situation where somebody's life's at stake and you have to lie, I don't see anything wrong with that. And there's scriptural examples of it. And the Hebrew midwives are one of the classic examples. Now, you could argue that they weren't lying. They were telling the truth, as I just said, that, you know, these Hebrew women, they are more vigorous. They work hard in the fields. They have babies real quick, in which case they weren't lying, in which case the Hebrew women wouldn't serve my argument. And in fact, in favor of that proposition that they were telling the truth and did not sin, is it would have been easy for Pharaoh to ascertain the truth. It would have been easy, if they'd been lying, it would have been easy for Pharaoh to expose the lie. So maybe they were telling the truth, figuring that if the Pharaoh investigated, he'd find out it was true. Okay. Well, if you're going to take that tack, then I'd have to go to Rahab lying about the Israelites when she let the silver cord down the wall to save their lives. And she said, they went that away. The Hebrew spies went that away when they went this way. We could talk about that. But anyway, that's enough of that thorny theological question. The Hebrew midwives in verse 21 were given households by God. That's probably families. Some people say material houses. They were given a house. But no, they were given families. Almost all the commentators say families, not material houses. Now, verse 21 says that he established households for them. And almost all the commentators say that he, God, established families for them, the Hebrew midwives. And I believe that's true. But Adam Clark's got an off-the-wall interpretation. He says that he refers to Pharaoh, and Pharaoh established houses, material, physical, mud brick houses for the Hebrew midwives, for the purpose of getting them out of their tents where they could hide their babies, put them in a house where he could keep their eye on them. Again, some of these commentators have got great imaginations. I don't think that's it at all. Now, in verse 22, Pharaoh commanded all his people, that would be his governmental officials. He'd given up on the midwives. They weren't going to do what he wanted. So he got his officials say, take the little kids and throw them into the Nile. Why didn't Pharaoh just call on his Egyptian officials at first? And my speculation is he probably figured he'd get less resistance using the midwives, but when you got the Egyptian officials going straight into the Hebrews' homes and saying, "We've got your kid and we're going to dump him into the Nile," that might start a slave revolt. Now, Adam Clark's got an interesting idea about throwing these babies in the Nile. Perhaps that there was another motive besides reducing the male population of the Hebrews. Perhaps there's another goal than just to kill the male babies. They might have also been throwing those male babies into the Nile River as a sacrifice to Pharaoh's God, and that sacrifice would therefore increase the country's fertility. In other words, it would reduce the Hebrew offspring, and it would increase the Egyptian offspring because those babies would be a sacrifice to Pharaoh's God. I don't know if that's true or not, but that's an interesting idea, I should say. Ladies and gentlemen, we have now finished Exodus chapter 1, verses 1 through 22. A new Pharaoh has enslaved Israel, and now that will prepare us for Exodus 2, verses 1 through 25, the entire chapter, which we'll do in our next audio. And we'll entitle that, Moses is Born and Flees to Midian. I hope you stay tuned for that audio, and I hope you enjoyed this one.